Good morning. Thanks for coming out. Appreciate everyone being time this morning and for giving me the opportunity to tell you a little bit about the work we're doing. Maybe somebody's head is in the slide back there. I might want to move a little bit. And thanks, Bob, for inviting us. This is, as was mentioned, the second in a three-part mini-series, if you will, about this middle fork of the Snoqualmie River and some of the local efforts that primarily King County, but also the City of Seattle and the State of Washington and the Puget Sound Partnership and others have been up to trying to restore river habitat through this central reach in eastern King County. Today we're going to talk a little bit specifically about the Tolt River, which is a major tributary to the Snoqualmie River. And if you were here last week, you got cogent and pithy description of some of the regional issues and kind of what's happening with the Snoqualmie River and specifically the Middle Fork Snoqualmie River with regard to fisheries and salmon recovery planning that's going on there, and heard from Mike Wade at the Wild Fish Conservancy kind of about some of the critical floodplain issues and the role of floodplain interaction and channel migration zone and some of the science there and kind of why it's so central to what we're trying to do to restore ecological integrity to this area in King County. Today I'm going to talk to you specifically about this project that Seattle's been involved in with King County and with other agencies as well. And then Josh is going to come and talk in the first of two halves of his talk, really, about the significance of some of the different kinds of monitoring of restoration and of stream systems that relate to the work we're doing here in the Tolt and throughout the Middle Forks and Snoqualmie. If you weren't here last week, or even if you were, this is a quick bit of kind of context for you. This is a picture of the entire Snohomish River watershed, a major river basin in Puget Sound. The Snohomish River lets out down in Everett area. The Snoqualmie River is a major tributary to the Snohomish system, and the Tolt River right in the dead center of this picture is one of the major tributaries to the Snoqualmie. Two forks in the Tolt River. The green area is the north fork of the Tolt River, and the smaller upper area that's kind of under the print there is the south fork of the Tolt River, and is the reason that the City of Seattle is involved in this project essentially out in eastern King County is because about a third of the water for the metropolitan area of Seattle and municipalities comes from the south fork Tolt River. Just if you're curious, the water essentially north of the Ship Canal is coming from the Tolt River. So if you live here in the U District or around here, you're drinking Tolt water pretty much. This project is then an effort that was voluntary to restore some salmon habitat downstream of Seattle's water withdrawal system down at the very mouth of the river. Trying to help fish who include these species you see listed here on the left, and who are essentially challenged in all their life stages. Juveniles especially have this long, sort of difficult gauntlet to run getting out of their natal spawning streams. And so the rearing and refuge areas are really limited and challenging in different places through this system. And then there's also the need for improved spawning habitat, especially in the lower lower mainstem Tolt and areas just proximate to the Tolt, where spawning conditions were more abundant historically than they are today. The project that we did here is really looking at trying to restore some of the historic floodplain processes that existed right at this confluence, this critical hotspot in the basin. We've learned enough now basically to start trying to restore process and function rather than really focusing on trying to create structures and create so-called boutique streams. This picture shows you basically the project. This is Snoqualmie River flowing to the north here. This is the Tolt River coming in. This town of Carnation is basically right up here today. Highway 203 coming across right in here. So that should hopefully orient you to where we are. And you can see that before this levee was constructed, there was a lot of different channel dynamics going on and a lot of interaction between the floodplain and the river here. But just after this photo was taken, in fact, possibly evidenced by some of the gravel scalping you see here, maybe right when this photo was taken, there was a levee constructed along the entire right bank of the river here that basically kept the Tolt right in this little straight shot and reduced the dynamic geomorphic habitat unit there to just basically one long glide of about a half a mile in length. So this project involves three goals, though, because of where it's located. The first is, as I say, to restore some of the floodplain connectivity and get back to some natural channel formation process that will benefit primarily fish, but also a variety of wildlife. But because of where we are, right here adjacent to the city of Carnation and essentially in one of Keene County's significant regional parks, we had tandem and equal goals of trying to maintain the same level of flood protection from the Tolt River, not the Snoqualmie per se, but from the Tolt River that the levee has historically done, as well as improving some of the park amenities there. And this basically put us up against a number of social challenges right from the very start. The first is that this area, if you've been here a while, you know, experiences pretty severe and chronic flooding from the Snoqualmie River primarily, the Tolt River not so much. But there's a great concern on the part of the public anytime you tinker with a river or a levee system out there at all that what you're going to do is going to exacerbate the flood problems that already exist. So you have to really work within a context of a lot of concern about flooding and a lot of priority about protection from flooding over all kinds of other management objectives in the river system. Secondly, the project's, as I mentioned, in a public park, and that stretch of the Tolt River there that goes right from the highway bridge down to the mouth of Snoqualmie is a very popular place for young people especially to come and intertube down that little stretch of river in the summer. So people are very concerned when you start doing things that change the structure of the channel there because of the use of the river in the summer. And then finally, because of where we're located here, right at the confluence of two significant rivers where there's historically been a lot of salmon migration, it's a site of a lot of prehistoric activity, and a lot of cultural resources lie right around the site, so we had to be very careful about those issues as we approach this project. So let me begin giving you a little tour of what we did out here. This project essentially had the goal, as I say, of restoring this roughly 50 acres of floodplain that historically existed back to connection with the main stem Tolt River. And so the fundamental effort of the project was to remove almost all of this half mile of levee that was constructed, earth and rock levee, and build a new modern standard levee back here at the edge of the historic floodplain with identical elevations across the elevation here, so you can basically guarantee the same level of flood protection from the Tolt River. Just the Tolt, mind you. Obviously, the Snoqualmie comes up, it floods on either side of this, and that's an important piece that we had to keep reminding people throughout. Then, because the river hasn't really been in here in 80 or 90 years, we did some things to give the floodplain a little bit of structure so that the instability of channel formation that's going to go on out here could be reduced, and we could basically try and jumpstart some of the natural process a little bit, which of course would involve the recruitment of large logs and large woody debris that would turn into large log jams that would then form into floodplain islands to give the channels a little bit of geometric structure so that you don't just end up with a river fire hosing back and forth in here for a long time, not creating the kind of good fish habitat that we're after. So we constructed a series of six engineered log jams that I'll show you in detail here in a minute as final piece of that. Then there's a woody revetment here that protects Keene County's only campground and the site of a number of different cultural resources, like I mentioned, to keep the river channel once it goes back in here from blasting right through this campground and park amenity here. Then finally, there's this historic set of channels that you see out here in the floodplain still today, including a couple of inlets where the river is most likely to kind of come in. So to encourage the river to take an initial channel geometry and give it a little bit, as I say, a little bit more stability initially, we excavated a couple of pilot inlet tributaries, which give the river sort of a most likely place to begin avulsing and coming into this floodplain. And then we moved from the end of this existing channel. All this area had been filled in basically by sediment deposition from the Snoqualmie and reforestation over the decades. Continuing this channel here basically created a pilot outlet channel, basically creating a place where the river can first have an easiest place to go through here. But as I say, over the course of history, we don't care if the river goes this way or just where it goes. We've given it this boundary condition basically here, so we know that the river is going to stay in here. But how it flows through here is a matter of chance and something we're not concerned about. For example, this is just a potential channel configuration of how things may look in the future. We don't know if all the water will come in this upstream tributary inlet or this downstream one, but we think that what will happen is most of the water will begin to come in here. It's the lowest spot, and then will flow across these engineered logjam structures and down out through this outlet channel. Some of the flow may come back up here and join into this other north relic channel up here. It may look like this, it may not. Just gives you an idea of kind of what we're after and how we're trying to begin diversifying the floodplain channel geometry out here. So these ELJs are pretty impressive structures. I encourage you to get out, and we weren't able to put together a field trip for this talk, but I really encourage you to go out and check some of this stuff out, especially now before we haven't had a big flood. We finished building this project just this past fall, but this past winter, as you probably realize, has been fairly mild. We haven't had any big floods. So the river hasn't shifted out and into this floodplain yet, so you can still see these things in their post-construction, pre-occupation kind of phase. Plan view of this project, of this ELJ, is basically you're talking about a structure that's about 100 feet wide that involves a couple hundred 18-inch pilings driven 30 to 40 feet down into the ground, basically creating a big fence row of log wood pilings interlaced with a lot of large woody debris and root wads. You see in the cross section over here that the essence of the design really is based on the use of super large pencils. No, actually what these are is pilings with steel tips and bands on them to make it a little easier to drive them down into the floodplain. In various places we didn't know how hard it was going to be to get down into the embedment depth, but the success and essence of the design is based on the notion that you get this pile wall down deeper than the maximum scour depth you would see from the river hitting the face of this engineered logjam. Basically, you don't want this thing blowing out, and if you put these piles down deep enough, then even though when the river floods and hits this thing full on, it's going to scour material out in front, but as long as it doesn't scour all the way to the bottom of this guy's going to stay in place. So here's what these things look like. First, we drive the piles, as I said, basically create this big crescent crescent face to the jam. All these have been driven to a specific pile depth, and then we begin cutting them off so that we can lay the wood in among them and trenched out in front of them. And you can see we've excavated pretty deeply here. I mean, this guy's 5-something feet. So this is about 20 feet of drop. And we basically know that when the river comes through here, at some point, full speed, if it hits this, it's going to scour out material to this depth. So we want to have the face of the log jam down in here where it will be part of the active future channel. Then we fill it up with literally thousands of pieces of large woody debris and then backfill the whole thing with large ballast rock in the back to keep it from floating away, and then covering it with soil and planting the top so that it can begin mimicking, as I say, a natural channel island. And then just turning you through the rest of these parts, as I mentioned, there's this pilot outlet channel that we constructed, essentially taking this historic channel that just terminated right here in a wetland pond and constructing a nice flowing outlet channel that takes it out through here and to the Snoqualmie River. Maybe, should be, and likely will be the place where the river first begins to reoccupy the floodplain. And then, as I said, the essence of this project was removing the old levee. So here it is before we removed it. Snoqualmie River's down here. Here's the Tolt River flowing right through here, and here's the big levee right here that we pulled out. And here in low flow time of year, you're basically talking about an elevation difference between the top of the levee and down here of about 10 feet. So it really was a pretty big structure. Here we've removed on the top left all the large rock armoring and begun the removal process, and then the bottom we basically have removed all the levee material we're going to remove, and this basically matches the existing grade of the wetland and floodplain that's back behind the former levee, so that it basically restores the floodplain to its previous elevation. This is just evidencing that stuff began to move a little bit already. This just past fall we had one small little flood event, nothing significant, but already it began to cause the river to creep up and take over some of that floodplain bank, even though the river stayed in its main channel. It hasn't reoccupied the floodplain in terms of a new primary channel yet, but it did begin to diversify some just in a little bit of flow, which came from these the inlet channels. As I mentioned, upstream, this is the Tolt River flowing past here, and we excavated these channels that connect into existing channels out there in the floodplain. And then, as I said, we were committed to providing the same level of flood protection to the community, so we built what's called a setback levee, a levee back at the edge of the floodplain, a hardened toe rock levee planted with native vegetation, and then laid up with a nice new regional trail connection on top to contribute to some of the mini park amenities that we brought. So I'm going to talk a little bit now about lessons that we learned on this project. It's fun to do show and tell, but I'm really hoping to make this an opportunity to convey to you some of the hard-fought things that I and we have learned over the time we built this project. As was mentioned in that introduction, I've essentially been working on this project since I came to work for Seattle Public Utilities in 2001, and that means it took me almost a decade to get this thing built and done. And so it evidences how much how much work it is. And hopefully also I can evidence some of the really critical lessons. If you haven't been out in the working world much yet, it will be hard to appreciate maybe the scope of some of this, but to the degree that you can internalize any of this vicariously from me and not have to go through some of the stuff that you go through to get to some of these points, I think it'll be of tremendous value to you, if I can brag as much. The first thing that was really critical, I mean, we're talking about a project that involved a partnership between three agencies at King County and two agencies at the City of Seattle, and then funding from three or four federal agencies and two state agencies and three or four local agencies. So you got a whole lot of folks with an interest and a stake in this thing, and then you got a whole lot of folks actually planning and managing and involved in the day-to-day effort to build it. So the first thing is really important and can be easily sort of let aside when you're really focusing on the technical aspects of trying to design a good project, and this is true of a restoration project or a building or anything you do, is that it's really important to create a good communications plan and revisit it often and know where you are with regard to your partners and your stakeholders and communication so that everyone's on the same page. It can be immensely difficult to do, but the payoffs are great if you can show the kind of discipline it takes to adhere to it. Related to that is the importance of not waiting for formal communications opportunities. You'll find in working with government agencies especially, but in projects that involve major milestones, there's a tendency to want to wait until a specific milestone transpires to orient a significant communication, like a public meeting or that kind of thing, to that kind of milestone. And what can often happen is that projects can drag on and the milestones can get bumped out a little, and suddenly what happens is you haven't really spoken to folks, like in this case, the City of Carnation. You can let too many months go by and then people start to assume that you're not building the project, or the rumor mill says that you're doing this or that, and you can really lose traction by not staying in communication with folks who are stakeholders to work you're doing. So it's important to pick up the phone and create communication opportunities even in an informal way. And then lastly is the importance of trying to be transparent in your efforts. There's politics in everything, but when you're trying to work with a number of different partners, it's super critical to try to communicate what your real needs are and what your real goals are, and trying to be demanding of your partners in the same way so that everyone kind of knows where everyone's coming from. In this partnership, we at Seattle Public Utilities had the goal of doing restoration far less than we had the goal initially of really enhancing the park. But of course, the King County Parks Department really had the opposite goal. So it was important for us to really work through the different kind of perspectives and be honest with where we're trying to go. Next thing I want to talk about is how we talk to the public a little bit. And it's just an example of this. One of the things that the community was really concerned with out here in Carnation area was the role of the Tolt River flow as related to the Snoqualmie River. And a general public perception that the water from the Tolt River hitting straight into, T-boning straight into the Snoqualmie River was what was historically holding the Snoqualmie River over on the very left side of the valley there, and keeping that Snoqualmie River from moving through town. So it was the belief, pretty natural sort of impression, that the hydraulic force of the water hitting the Snoqualmie River just held it over there. Well, of course, what's really happening is that the alluvial fan of the Tolt River creates a big sediment wedge that keeps the Snoqualmie River following gravity and not flowing over the other direction. So when you hear that concern from people, you can tell them the answer in a couple of different ways. The first is you can just tell them straight up that the alluvial fan deposition at the confluence is what's causing the thing to stay in place and prohibit the lateral channel avulsion and not the hydraulic interaction between the two rivers. Or you can say, look, the sand and gravel that settles out the mouth of the Tolt, when it slows down and hits the Snoqualmie, creates a big pile of dirt, and when the water hits it, it goes around that. So it's more about the dirt than it is the water, even though it seems like the water moves it. The point being that technical folks, we tend to use a lot of different vernacular and jargon, and when you start using technical jargon with folks in the public and not using lay language, people just shut down immediately. They begin to immediately believe you're trying to lie to them and confuse them and keep them from understanding your real objectives. And when that happens, people stop trusting and stop listening, and you essentially violate your fundamental effort of going to talk to the public, which is helping them understand what you're doing and why. Next thing I want to talk about a little bit is referring to some adaptive management stuff. Is some of the ways that we try and make this work. First is use the right people for the project. We mixed in this project, we used folks from King County to do some of the primary flood system design. We used some leading consultants to do the design on the engineered log jams and some of the critical geomorphology and modeling calculations. And we used folks from Seattle Public Utilities to do a lot of the actual plans and schematics and construction management of the project. So if you create a good team, then you can draw from a number of different sources for building a complex project, and you don't get stuck with trying to do it unilaterally. Next is, people will often say you should in environmental science and ecosystem restoration, where people say, well, let the science make the decision. And I'm going to suggest to you that it's a bad idea to try to let the science make the decision. Science is essentially the way we produce information from data. And information is the thing we should use to make decisions, but people have to make decisions. Science and information don't make decisions for you. And in many cases, you have to weigh the benefits of one set of outcomes against the benefits of another set of outcomes, and so there isn't some sort of very clear, scientifically preferred kind of way to go. We tried in this project to refer to reference conditions and look at what had happened historically. But we also had to make decisions within this complex balance of objectives that I referred to here at the park in the city of Carnation. The best example of this is from what happened in January of 2009. If you were around here, you may remember that we had a record rainstorm flood event. It rained almost 2 feet in about 30 hours up in the Central Cascades. And the Snoqualmie and the Tolt saw record flows that day or that set of days. And one of the things that happened was the Tolt River upstream avulsed through some historic forest and brought a huge raft of large wood down the river to the mouth. Here's the Snoqualmie here, and here's the Tolt River coming down. And when the Tolt River hit the Snoqualmie with all this wood, it went up over the historic levee and racked up into this gigantic new log jam that formed. Literally thousands of pieces of wood. I mean, we're talking about almost a half mile of wood, 15 feet deep and 60 feet across. So a big log jam. And so that left us with a really difficult question, which was, well, we're out here trying to put all this large woody debris into the floodplain. Here it came like manna from heaven. The project's done, right? Or at least this part of it. We should just leave this in place and call it good. And that was our natural inclination, certainly, with the restoration goal. And as science and management who really appreciate the role of wood in rivers, It seemed kind of anathema to us to pull it out. But we thought, well, we better start doing a really rigorous technical analysis in any case to see how it affects our project objectives and try and step back from our subjective inclinations. And when we did that, a few things really started to become apparent to us. One of the most interesting things about the historic site here is the role of these distributary channels that have formed historically when the Snoqualmie River and the Tolt River and the Snoqualmie River flooding create these channels that are flowing northerly across the floodplain up here, kind of through here. And the realization that if we didn't remove the levee down in here, we would essentially eliminate the capacity for that kind of habitat to form. And secondly, the realization that with the wood on top of the big rock levee, we couldn't remove the levee, but the wood was high enough up on the levee that it really was going to be the case that only in a really huge flood event was any of the river going to be up against any of this wood. mostly what we had was a big pile of wood that was in the park, which was right here close to the town of Carnation, that very likely could have ended up being King County's largest bonfire, and that would have been the end of that logjam. So we made the surprising decision through a lot of different scientific discussion about this to actually remove all this wood so that we can continue with the project to remove the levee. But what we did was we took all this wood and stockpiled it right over here, and then when we came time to build these engineered log jams, we were able to reuse every bit of that wood, and it provided us about 95% of the large woody debris we needed for the project, coincidentally. So just running through a few little other lessons, and then I'm going to hand it off to Josh. When you're doing construction projects, and certainly when doing complex ecological restoration projects, do all the needed modeling you need. It's easy to skip modeling steps, to assume you know what you're doing, but it's often very important to do the right kind of modeling. It had a huge input on how we ended up finally designing and redesigning and redesigning the engineered log jams and their location on this site. Finally, value engineer the heck out of things. This means once you've gotten to a 90% design, sit down with the folks who have the responsibility and the experience in building stuff and go through it. It's the standard problem of architects not understanding how contractors work. They usually do, but they don't always know enough. And so when you sit down and you batter stuff around, you can really learn a lot about how well your design can actually be put into the ground. And you can come up with a lot of different contingency approaches to solving problems. Like, for example, with ours, if we couldn't get the embedment depth pile driving the wood in the engineered log jams, then we had to make plans for how to get it in otherwise. Happily, we only had a few piles that didn't go deep enough. Next, stay persistent. Complex habitat projects take a long time. They take longer than you think they should, and if you really stay focused and keep your eye on the prize, you can make it in the long run. Ask hard questions about the project's technical and fiscal merit. If you're going to get involved in a project that takes a number of years and agencies to build, it's going to cost a lot of money. And if you can't continue to convince yourself that it's worth the time and money for the habitat benefits or other benefits you're getting, then you won't be able to convince the public of the same thing. And lastly, learn from doing. Monitoring data is key. It's the thing that will answer all the key questions that improve the future work as you look to continue to do better and better. We never would have gotten to the point of being able to do some of the process restoration if we hadn't been studying and learning over the past couple of decades about the role of geomorphic process and how important it is to move into that paradigm. And so with an eye on monitoring and its use, I'm going to hand it over to Josh to begin talking a little bit about that side of the equation.
Okay, just give me one sec to get my show loaded up here. As I'm listening to Brent, I'm thinking putting together a monitoring plan is awfully similar to putting together a restoration project like this sounds awfully similar to putting together a monitoring plan, especially when there's multiple people involved. Today, because this is a two-part talk, I'll kind of be giving you the big picture context part of the presentation, and then next week I'll give you something you can sink your teeth into in terms of details and designs and methodologies. Today I'll be mostly focused on the approach that we've used to monitoring all of these projects and some of the hypotheses that we're testing. You've already heard from a few speakers about the situation, and suffice it to say that large river restoration is really picking up steam as these big salmon habitat plans are being implemented. And a lot of the big projects involve common themes like pulling out infrastructure to reinstate channel migration and reconnect the floodplain. A lot of projects involve placing wood, allowing for increased recruitment and retention of wood, and almost every single one of them involves some element of revegetation. And implementing these big projects on big rivers is still a fairly new thing, especially in fairly developed areas. And so as much thought as goes into these things, the outcomes are still somewhat uncertain. And because they're near infrastructure, near communities, there's potential risks involved. And there's a high perceived cost of failure, as well as because of the size of these things, there's a high cost to achieve success. They're just great big projects. But there's also a high potential benefit. And so when you add those three ingredients together, we really believe that some good effectiveness monitoring is warranted because, as Brent mentioned, we really have to learn from doing. And so this is an example of a case study in which we have lots of big projects happening in close proximity to one another. And so we decided at the very outset that we really needed to have one monitoring plan that encompassed all of these projects. If for no other reason there was an efficiency of scale, we were also curious to see how these projects might interact with one another. It's also important when you're asking questions about the effects of a project to be asking those questions at the right spatial scale and the right time scale and not drill down into one particular place. So I'm going to take one step back really quick and answer this first question, which is the most basic, is why are we monitoring in the first place? And I think there's a lot of different answers to this question. But in my mind, the most important answer is that we're trying to shift the distribution curve here over to here. So if you imagine we have a certain number of projects that get done every year, if we're living in kind of an optimistic world, we might think that most of those projects are moderately effective. What we really want is for all of those projects, or more of those projects, to achieve a higher level of effectiveness. So we're really trying to shift that distribution curve toward the right so that we get more projects with better outcomes. And this helps us determine whether the projects that we're doing are meeting our objectives. And as Brent mentioned, we're really trying to reduce uncertainty in the future projects so we know how to predict the outcomes better. And I think there's another way of thinking about this too, and it's a difficult mindset to adopt as the project manager, especially when you're trying to ensure that everyone is going to trust in the outcome. This is actually a quote that I borrowed from the New York Times just the other day. It said, and I thought it applied to monitoring and project implementation, "We only progress through a series of regulated errors, and that every move is a partial failure to be corrected by the next one." And this really resonated with me because I think the key here is regulated errors. There's probably no project in the world that's ever been done to 100% success. And that every single project could have been a little bit better had we known a little bit more. And the key here is to use monitoring to set up a system of regulation, a way to regulate that error so that if it does occur, you're paying attention in a reliable way. And even if a partial failure happens, you can correct it the next time. And so the systematic nature of the monitoring is an important part of this. And it's not easy. There's lots of different kinds of monitoring. Most of what we're talking about in this context is what you'd consider a case study. There's a lot of interest in particular projects and what they did, and drilling down into individual projects to figure out what a particular feature did. And that's where a lot of the interest comes in. But there's other important questions that need to be asked at the programmatic level, like what kinds of projects are giving us the most benefits. At larger scales, we need to know the overall trends in the conditions of watersheds. So there's a lot of status and trends monitoring that's done. And ultimately, in terms of species recovery, we're interested in whether or not the populations are becoming more viable. So even if you identify great ways to do the monitoring at each of these levels, it becomes really difficult to link these different questions together, to have them use common metrics, common currency. And that's a challenge we're still struggling with. But right now, most of what you hear from me is a case study that's intended to help us understand more about the effects of big restoration projects that involve levee setbacks and wood placements. So as we're doing these projects, we're thinking about some of these same things as when we're doing the monitoring planning. We really have several key premises here, and these are a little oversimplified, but I like the way that they connect. The idea is that process interacts with structures to create critical habitats, and that these habitats are dynamic and evolving over time. This is a different view than creating a static habitat condition that will persist forever. And so I'll talk about the relevance of that to how we do the monitoring. One of the ways that it appears is how we formulate our hypotheses about what's going to happen. So these are essentially just predictions about the outcomes. We collect data then to test these hypotheses and see if they're true, or see if we can refute them. So they focus on a pretty comprehensive array of different metrics, and I'll talk about these more next week. We're interested in the effects on rearing habitat, connections to the floodplain, channel dynamics, wood delivery and recruitment, and sediment characteristics for spawning. as well as whether or not the riparian forest is renewing itself. And we do that in a controlled setting, and in this case, we call that our experimental design. We're using an unreplicated before-after control impact design, which, to cut through the jargon, just means we look at two different places, both before we do the project and after we do the project, and if we actually have had an effect, these project or these sites that used to track one another before we did the restoration should now be different. And that helps us understand whether or not we've actually had an effect on the project site or whether or not the river is just naturally changing and responding to climate and such things. So we have a treatment reach here that I've showed you already before. There's the Tolt going down river quite a ways here. There's our control reach. That's Fall City. The Raging River comes out, and our control reach goes downstream there. So that's not intended to be a reference condition, but instead a portion of the river that was prior to restoration behaving somewhat like the treatment reach. So we're tracking process rates, things that I mentioned in the hypotheses before. And I'll get into the details of this next week. But I wanted to explain why we're thinking about processes first and foremost. And this is just made up data to illustrate the point here. Let's say we're tracking changes in habitat area in response to our project. And we have on the left here a project that goes out and really just creates habitat where there was none before. It's highly engineered, but it's not necessarily working with the processes. So this is intended to represent the processes aren't fixed. Processes are still broken, but we've engineered some habitat. And what we see is a pretty big increase because we literally put the habitat where none existed before. But because the process rate isn't fixed, that habitat's not necessarily going to be maintained by the river over time. So if you contrast that with a different approach that fixes the habitat or the process rate, the idea is that habitat area will gradually increase, but probably not as quickly, and will be variable over time. And if this has a relevance to monitoring, in that depending on whether you're looking at just the habitat area or the habitat area and process rates, it might lead you to two different conclusions. So if your monitoring window is really short, you might look at this project and say, well, the habitat area is really big now, and the project was a huge success. But had you looked another 5 or 10 years, you'd see that it was unsupported at that site, and it was doomed, essentially. On the other hand, if you looked at the process rates as well, you might say, well, we didn't really see much of an increase in the habitat area there, but the process rate is back up to where we want it to be, and we anticipate that that will support more habitat over time. So, and I thought Reinhard Stettler had a great quote from the book that he talked about in the first presentation, I think, of this quarter, which was that what drives our planet are processes, and the products are incidental and temporary. And I thought that really was spot on. So, but of course, structure is also important, and so we are tracking these things. And I'll talk more about that next week. And of course, fish are notoriously difficult to monitor at individual project sites, but we are tracking adults and juveniles, and I'll talk about that next week too. So this is just a placeholder. And ultimately, we'll synthesize this information, which is more difficult than it sounds, especially with a comprehensive monitoring plan. But the kinds of generalized questions that we'll answer, in addition to testing our specific hypotheses, are the processes recovering? Do we actually see enhancement of the critical habitats? Do fish use those? And as Brent mentioned, an important part of this story is, were the public interests protected? And this work can only happen if the public interests are protected. And so we'll also be looking to see how can we improve this kind of project and these kinds of projects in the future, and what were the big surprises, if any. So you might think, well, that's it. Now comes the acknowledgement slide. That's the next one after this one, but I think this is where we need to focus for a little while, and I think this has relevance to anybody that's going to be involved either in the planning side, the implementation side, or the monitoring. And even if you're not planning on getting involved in applied sciences at all and rather want to just do the pure research, this is how it's all connected in my mind. So let's take one step way back and figure out where these strategies came from. We really have these, once we recognize that Chinook are in trouble, we have these strategies that are informed by the literature. best available science, and that turns into recovery plans or restoration plans. And that really reflects the input of not only the science, but the citizens and the institutions that are going to be charged with carrying out these plans. Those plans, in essence, are a collection of projects and project locations. And those projects get designed and built. We monitor them, and sometimes it stops there, unfortunately. Sometimes it stops here, and we don't even get to the monitoring. But once the monitoring has been done, as it is in this site, we have to get past just the data collection effort, synthesize and interrogate the data, and really understand what the data is telling us. How does it relate to our initial objectives? And then there's two important feedback loops that have to happen for this to be really useful. Number one, this synthesis has to go to answering these questions of whether or not the outcomes were acceptable to the public, to which we're ultimately have to answer to. Because as this diagram indicates, the citizens have input on both the plans and projects. And so they need to be hearing from us about how those projects are affecting the river and affecting them. But also, and this is, of course, it's an obvious step, but doesn't always happen. We need to take that synthesis, determine whether or not it really was effective, and then take that information back to the institutions that are implementing the projects and back into the peer-reviewed literature to inform and support the broader knowledge base. There's a lot of reasons. This could be a whole talk right here, why these gaps exist. But it's a challenge that we're facing and we're really trying to anticipate and address. But that information really has to get back to the institutions, almost first and foremost, because they are the ones, the groups that are putting projects in the ground are the ones that are going to take that information and change the designs and implementation in the future. So monitoring you're not done once you've done the monitoring. You have to take that out and essentially have a communications plan for getting the results out to the right audiences. And just to expand on something that Brent had said too, one of the things that can happen is you present the data in a very technical format, and sometimes you might be right on message, but a little bit off target if you're not really using the data to answer questions that are pressure points or lever points for the institutions and the science. So you have to be thinking about what is it that they really need to hear or learn from this. And so next week I'll talk about specific metrics and methodologies that we're using and how we're testing individual hypotheses. But for this week, this is just kind of the arm-waving and big picture story. And now comes the acknowledgement slide, and I think we have another few minutes to address some questions.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay. Questions?
Yeah.
Repeat the question.
Sure. His question is, given the level of public concern about their well-being right there in Carnation and the proximity of the Tolt Project to Carnation and the historic agricultural use out there, how did we address that in light of trying to meet the public need with the project? For the Tolt Levee Project, a huge amount of it, and this is often the case, and Josh has lots of experience this way too, a huge amount of it is just trying to work with the public and get them engaged in a series of meetings and efforts to help people understand kind of some of the basic science and overcome some of the myths about it. People had the concern that if we took the Tolt Levee out, that they were suddenly going to see a radical increase in flooding. But in fact, most of the flooding out there comes from the Snoqualmie River, and the Tolt River levee has no effect whatsoever on the Snoqualmie's flooding, as just as one example. Often it's just a matter of working to build a relationship with folks, and this kind of goes to some of my talk, is just staying in enough connection that people will begin to sort of let their guard down and hear what you're trying to say and ask the right questions that then you have legitimate and thoughtful answers to, and a dialogue can begin, and then you can start to hear what their real needs are from their part, and they can start to hear how you really think you can meet them from your part, and it, hopefully in the middle you meet with something that works. Also, we're trying to recover, I think, something of a legacy of the government going on and just doing stuff And then sometimes it works great, but other times it fails miserably. Often the government then doesn't even acknowledge that failure. And folks with historical sort of on-the-ground understanding of how the world works can see that, you know, that it's a big lie in ways if it's being perpetrated on them like that. So having a more active and organic dialogue with the community makes a huge difference in terms of how you approach designing and thinking about a project.
Another tangible thing that you'll hear about next week from Dan Eastman is at a site downstream from the toll project that Brent was talking about. The concern wasn't as much about flooding as it was about where the channel might go once the rock was gone. And so they actually worked with some faculty from the University of California to come up with a model to predict where the channel might move to. And that was used as a way to discuss the issue with some of the downstream landowners that were concerned about it. In that case, it was a little different because there was only one main landowner instead of an entire town or, you know, parts of the town. Mm-hmm. So,
no, it was very much of a challenge.
Question again?
Oh, I'm sorry. The question was, in light of what seems to be a recent year's strong upsurge in distrust for government, did that kind of play into our relationship with them, or did we build a sort of bond and a bridge early that overcame that? And that too could be like a whole talk. In fact, when I was a grad student 15 years ago here, I was running a project called the Trust in Government Project, as all this stuff was just sort of starting to change face and focus. But I would say that was one of the biggest challenges, was that the huge level of mistrust that exists in the community and the level of resentment for folks, especially in his agency, but to some degree also in the city of Seattle, in terms of their disregard for sort of property rights and the freedoms of the rural community. And it took a lot of back and forth for us to really convince the community, you're going to get a better park, you're going to get a new levee that protects you from flooding better, and we're going to restore habitat. And happily, folks are now quite content with the project, the outcome. But a big part of the reason it took 9 years to build this thing is because you just have to have, as I mentioned, the persistence to work through the fear and distrust that the community has for whether the local government can really do something in their best interest.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.